My name is Jesse Augustine. I am currently the legal counsel for the State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, and I'll be moderating today. Before we begin, just wanted to thank Kate Fugate of the National Chapter for helping make this event possible, and remind attendees that you can use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen to submit questions to the panel, which then I will read out to them. So setting the stage for our discussion today, Wisconsin Supreme Court term and review, the makeup of the court is changing. In the last three Supreme Court elections over the last 3 years, we now have new justices, Justice Dallet, Hagedorn, and Karofsky. And the court might be in for some more change. The next election is in 2023, when Chief Justice Rogensack will be up for re-election. The Chief Justice will be 82 years old, and she has not announced whether she's going to plan on running for another term. Despite what you might see in some media about the court being split along ideological lines, 42% of the cases in the 2019-2020 term were decided unanimously. Even in cases with non-unanimous votes, the dividing line is not as stark as it might appear at first blush. Percentage of these cases voted for in the majority each term, Justice Ziegler was 96% with the majority, Chief Judge Rogensack 84, Justice Kelly 79, Justice Hagedorn 61, Justice Rebecca Bradley 52, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley 50, and Justice Dallet 42%. So I'm hoping that our panelists can address some of these dynamics today, and I'll start by introducing them. Lane Ruland is special counsel at Hush Blackwell LLP. She works on regulatory issues, election law, campaign finance compliance, and legislative affairs, among other things. She previously served as Director of Environmental and Energy Policy at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and before that served as Deputy Chief of Staff to Wisconsin's Attorney General. Ryan Walsh is a partner at Eimer Stahl LLP. He focuses on corporate counseling and appellate and complex litigation in a wide variety of areas, including antitrust, constitutional law, corporate law, and higher education law. Ryan was a law clerk on the U.S. Supreme Court for the Honorable Justice Scalia, and previously served as Wisconsin's Chief Deputy Solicitor General under today's other panelist, Misha Saitlin. Ryan was named to Forbes 30 Under 30 Law and Policy list in 2017. And as mentioned, Misha Saitlin is the former Solicitor General of Wisconsin. He was a clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court for the Honorable Judge Anthony Kennedy. When asked if there was anything I should highlight about his career, because it's extensive, he responded that I should say that he has litigated, quote, a lot before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So that actually leads me into the first topic I'd like to bring up today, which is a case that Misha and I worked on together. He was our lead counsel in DNC versus Bostelman. So Misha, would you like to give us some background on that case and let us know what happened yesterday?
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you, Jesse, for introducing us and for having us. And thank you, everyone who jumped on for this call. So DSC versus Bostelman is part of a series of lawsuits brought by the Democratic Party and others seeking to change Wisconsin election laws before the November election. The district court granted some relief to the plaintiffs in the form of a preliminary injunction. And then the legislature, along with the RNC, appealed. The Seventh Circuit held that the legislature, officially held that the legislature did not have standing to appeal on behalf of the state. Then upon a motion for reconsideration, the Seventh Circuit, recognizing that this was a question of state law, certified the question to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. In a 4-3 decision yesterday written by Justice Hagedorn, the court held that under a statute that was enacted about 2 years ago, the legislature does in fact have standing to defend state law, including on appeal. That was a quite significant victory for the legislature and for the rule of law, because it prevents a situation where the attorney general can basically abandon the defense of law and have laws invalidated in court without any adversarial testing, including on appeal. The decision there will have far-reaching consequences in the future for any cases, especially those where the attorney general does not defend state law. But for purposes of the present case, the election case, it means that the appeal with regard to the preliminary injunction blocking Wisconsin laws is going to continue and will and a decision should be reached on the merits of that stay application by the Seventh Circuit.
When you say it'll have far-reaching consequences, could you expand on that a little bit?
Right. So the concern that animated some of the laws that the legislature acted 2 years ago was the attorney general being able to settle away state law or not defend state law, and there being no way to defend that law, and the law will end up being blocked by court order without any appellate review. In light of the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision, the legislature will be able to intervene in those cases and appeal, including in federal court, to make sure that Wisconsin laws get a fulsome defense.
Could you give us an example of some of the laws that were or that could potentially be affected now by this ruling, since the legislature has standing on appeal?
Well, right. So in this particular case, the court ordered that Wisconsin had to accept absentee ballots 6 days after Election Day. And of course, this could have a significant impact on the November election, which has including the presidential race, and Wisconsin is a swing state. Beyond this election, any number of laws that the legislature has enacted that could be seen as controversial, the legislature will be able to defend those laws, including on appeal, even if the attorney general chooses not to defend those laws or affirmatively argues against those laws.
Okay. Would you then go ahead and start on the background of the other case? You were going to talk about the veto cases, because obviously we saw a lot of action on that this year. There's Bartlett versus Evers and the Wisconsin Small Business United versus Brennan.
Right, of course. So for many years, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has created the broadest veto pen in the country. In essence, what that case law required or allowed the governor is to use a game of, frankly, Mad Libs to rewrite duly enacted appropriations laws that the legislature had passed by striking out words or combinations of words to mush up two sentences to have them have a different meaning than what the legislature had originally drafted. While there had been a couple of constitutional amendments limiting some of these abuses, such as the practice of striking out individual letters, the game had continued, and governors from both parties, frankly, had used this power that Wisconsin Supreme Court had recognized to change fundamentally the meaning of state laws. I mean, they would the governors would do things like, if legislature enacts a law says DNR may not do this, they would just strike out the word not, and it would say the DNR may do this, literally flipping the meaning of the sentence. And this led to a counter response. So the legislature, instead of using the phrase may not, started using cannot, one word, because you can't strike out half letter. And basically, this was not a serious enterprise. Now, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in a fractured decision, invalidated this historical practice, but did not set out a clear replacement test. The Chief Justice wrote an opinion where her test would be that, quote, the consequences of the partial veto must not alter the topic of subject matter of the whole bill before the veto. And this is germaneness, but this has, you know, fairly far-reaching consequences in stopping some of the worst abuses. Then Justice Kelly and Rebecca Bradley adopted essentially a line item veto test, which provides that the proper role of the partial veto is to separate the severable proposed laws that the legislature bundled into one appropriations bill. Meanwhile, Justice Hagedorn and Justice Ziegler adopted something like the germaneness test that the Chief Justice had articulated, but more strict. And the way they articulated it is, a partial veto is the power to negate some portion of policies and accept others, not to unilaterally create new policies that were never passed by the legislature. How this will cash out in the long term is still to be decided, but I think the bottom line is that the worst abuses that the governors have been doing, playing a game of Mad Libs, are now off the table.
Do you think that there will be a test case coming up for this in terms of, I mean, is it like something we'll see after the next budget? Obviously, we, you know, don't know what might be coming out of the legislature that the governor can take a crack at. But if you had a thought on when we might see this coming before the Supreme Court again, what would be your guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one to say because, you know, what cases could come up depends on how the governor uses his or after 2022 her pen. And so if they are going to stay within kind of traditional understandings of veto, there might not be a test case anytime soon. If they do try to get creative and aggressive, then I think after every biennial budget is the time to look for a test case.
That brings us to another area that's still being litigated, the SEIU versus Voss. So Misha, if you could fill us in on that one again.
Okay, I guess I got a lot to begin with here. So I mentioned in the when discussing the DNC versus Bostelman case, a couple of laws that the legislature had enacted 2 years ago. SEIU involved a separation of powers challenge to a whole suite of those laws, including the law that I just talked about with legislature authority to intervene and defend state law. There was a large number of different kind of provisions that were challenged, some to do with the legislature's role in litigation, some to do with oversight of a rulemaking, some to do with guidance documents. But the bottom line of the Wisconsin Supreme Court's ruling is that the vast majority of the laws the legislature enacted in extraordinary session have survived. And by that, I mean the court rejected the facial challenge to most of those laws. The litigation provisions are all still in place. The rule review and other joint committee provisions are all still facially and wholly in place. The court did, however, with Rebecca Bradley and Justice Kelly joining the traditional left side of the court, invalidate some of the guidance document provisions. Those required that whenever agencies issued a guidance document, they had to go through a notice and comment procedure just like they would with a rule. Justice Kelly wrote an opinion joined by a majority of the court that said that those infringed on the executive power basically to speak to the people, since guidance documents were not binding, and declared that those were unconstitutional.
What was the makeup of the decision otherwise? I mean, were there parts that you were unanimous, or was the rest of it split? Do you remember how that broke down?
Yeah, it was fairly complicated. On the most controversial aspects of the authority of the legislature over the Attorney General, that was split 5-2 among traditional ideological lines. Some of the other provisions, like the joint committee review provisions and the intervention provisions, those were actually unanimously upheld by all justices of the court, something that really wasn't broadly reported in the press. So contrary to the attack that the governor had launched, had launched on all of those, the votes from the court were unanimous in upholding those provisions.
Do you think, I know it's maybe getting a little ahead of the topic here, but do you think that gives us any idea what we might see in the future out of the current makeup of the court?
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows that one shouldn't get too caught up in, you know, one or two high profile cases and saying, well, this is now the swing justice. This is our, you know, John Roberts or Senator Day O'Connor. You know, in SEIU, actually Justice Hagedorn was completely with all of the arguments that the legislature had put forward and would have upheld all of the laws. And same with Justice Ziegler and Chief Justice Rogensack. Whereas Justice Kelly and Rebecca Bradley, who were seen by some as the most co-conservative members of the court, actually voted to strike down the guidance document provisions. So I think this shows that the court is not as easily predictable as, you know, the press may report it on it. And that's a good thing because, of course, each justice should think for themselves.
Okay. Well, we've heard a lot from Misha, so it's time to switch over to one of our other panelists, and I'll ask Lane to give us an update on the Lamar versus Division of Hearing and Appeals.
Sure. So thank you, Jesse. I'm going to be touching on a couple of those cases you mentioned that were, in fact, unanimous decisions relating to Wisconsin's Administrative Procedure Act. Typically, these cases are thought of, especially in current times, as maybe more controversial or more political. But these two particular cases that haven't received as much attention as some of the others we're discussing today show that, in reality, it doesn't have to be that way. So in the Wisconsin Supreme Court's first decision affecting the business community in the 1920 term, the court issued an important opinion on the limitations of agency authority in this case, Lamar Central Outdoor Advertising versus the Division of Hearings and Appeals. Generally speaking, the Supreme Court held that the Department of Transportation in this case was required to promulgate a rule when it changed its interpretation of statutes, specifically in this case regarding non-conforming billboards, but this principle applies more broadly to all state agencies when they reverse course on how they interpret a statute. So by way of summary of the facts of this case was about a billboard that was erected on a state highway in the early 90s. That highway became an interstate, which meant the sign then became legal but non-conforming because of the change in the type of roadway it was adjacent to. Lamar, the party in this case, acquired that legal non-conforming billboard in the late 90s. And then some years later, in 2012, Lamar applied to the Department of Transportation to actually remove some vegetation from that billboard. In the pictures that were submitted with that application, the department noticed that at some point there had been some extensions added to the billboard. And because of this, DOT determined that was in violation of administrative code, even though the enlargements and extensions had been removed. And instead of granting a permit to allow them to remove vegetation, the department said, you need to completely remove the billboard. So under previous interpretation of state law, the department permitted billboard owners to correct these illegal extensions within 60 days of discovery of them. But DOT had since reversed course on that interpretation, which then eliminated that 60-day cure phase, meaning that this particular sign became illegal the moment those extensions were added, based on the way DOT now interpreted the statute, even though the billboard was actually in compliance previously under their original interpretation. So you can imagine that this might cause, you know, a headache, to say the least, for the regulated community if agencies were allowed to reverse course in their interpretation of statutes, and has a very real and direct impact on the ability of the regulated community to function. So fortunately, the Supreme Court decided this case in favor of Lamar on the grounds that the rulemaking requirements of Chapter 227 required DOT to promulgate a rule before it changed its interpretation of the billboard non-conforming use statutes, namely the 60-day sort of right to cure phase. And maybe more importantly, the Supreme Court did not give weight to the Court of Appeals quote, error correcting exception to rulemaking, which would allow agencies to essentially reverse course, claiming it had been an error in the way they interpreted the statute, and not have to go through rulemaking. Well, in my mind, that exception is so large you could drive a truck through it and render a lot of the rulemaking requirements meaningless. So fortunately, the Supreme Court came down on the side of Lamar and said, no, before you change your interpretation of a statute, you need to promulgate a rule. Would you like me to move on to the next?
I didn't know that you ended your sentence kind of up, so I didn't know if you were building up to the big finale of the Lamar billboard case that we were all waiting for.
Finale. I was going to start on the next, but if there's any questions you have, I wanted to make sure I had time to answer those.
We said it was a unanimous decision. Do you remember who authored that? Just curious.
I do not off the top of my head.
I did. They all agreed, so just wondering.
That's right.
Okay. No, if you'd like to go on to the next one, please.
Sure. So I'm going to jump now to the Department of Health Services versus PAPA, which again dealt with administrative agency authority. A little bit of a different question here, whereas in the Lamar case, the question was, when is rulemaking required? And here, the court looked to another critical component of Chapter 227, which requires that agencies have explicit authority before they take action, whether it's rulemaking or any other sort of action. This decision, like the Lamar decision, was unanimous and again reaffirmed Chapter 227's requirement that state agencies indeed have to have explicit authority to act as a threshold manner. So again, unanimous, by way of summarizing the background here, the Supreme Court held that the Department of Health Services Medicaid auditing and clawback policies exceeded DHS's explicit recruitment authority based on statute. The decision was a huge win for the regulated community, as the court recognized Act 21's explicit authority requirement as the very first hurdle that an agency must clear before it imposes regulatory mandates. So Kathleen Papa, the named party in this case, and some members of the professional home care providers are certified Medicaid providers who work as nurses in independent practice. They provide in-home care to children and adults who are enrolled in the Medicaid program, and they bill their services directly to the Medicaid program. The Wisconsin legislature, through a provision in Chapter 49, authorizes the Department of Health Services to audit in-home Medicaid providers for fraud or overpayment and to recoup funds in error. DHS has promulgated some rules based on this statutory authority, but effectively the standard comes down to, can the Medicaid providers prove that they did the work that they billed for? And for many of these providers, this Medicaid recruitment is the sole source of income. However, based on the way DHS was interpreting some of the statutes, if these Medicaid providers' documentation wasn't perfected, DHS's recruitment could cost them up to 5 years of past earnings. So for some, that's 5 years of their sole income. Based on this, DHS's policy became known as the perfection rule. Again, because you needed to have perfect paperwork or you could lose everything, even when there was no dispute as to whether you did the work or not. And so Kathleen Papa and other providers eventually sued. It eventually came before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And I will read a quote that I think perfectly sums up what this case is about. And in this case, the author of the opinion was Justice Ziegler. And she said, "The crux of this case is the scope of DHS's recoupment authority. No agency may implement or enforce any standard, requirement, or threshold unless that requirement or threshold is explicitly required or explicitly permitted by statute or by a rule." This particular section of Wisconsin statutes does not explicitly require or permit DHS to enforce this perfection policy. So again, a very clear directive, unanimous affirmation that Chapter 227 requires this explicit authority, and agencies can only act within those explicit boundaries of their authority. And without that explicit authority, they have no power.
In your practice, I know you work with a lot of private clients. Have they already felt the impacts of these cases? Are there other agencies that were starting to kind of push the boundaries or maybe make some rules that didn't fall within the Act 21 scope? Or have you noticed any of that on your own?
Certainly. I mean, in my experience, agencies are sort of always trying to push the envelope, whether intentionally or not, on what they're explicitly allowed to do. We'll talk a little bit about another case that I think is going to be critical in very clearly answering this question of explicit, you know, versus implicit authority. And these are the Clean Wisconsin and Kennard cases relating to high capacity wells. But I guess I've noticed mostly with my clients is a recognition now that this requirement exists, where maybe before, it wasn't as well known to the regulated community that indeed agencies are quite restricted by the language of Chapter 227.
Oh, this brings us to a different sort of case, but obviously had a great impact around the state legislature v. Palm. And Lane, if you would give us some background on the case and then what the arguments were.
Yeah, certainly. So I think this particular case, which as most of us know, was definitely not unanimous, brings together the two major issues that were in play in the Lamar case and the Papa case, namely, when is something a rule in rulemaking required? And then, second to that, when does an agency have that explicit authority? And again, is that explicit authority what's required to act in the first place? So we're all quite familiar with what the Safer at Home order did. It made it illegal in most cases to leave your home with certain exceptions. It shut down businesses, except those which were determined to be essential. It was issued unilaterally, ultimately not by the governor, but by the DHS secretary designee, Andrea Palm. And Ryan and I, on behalf of the legislature, pursued a lawsuit directly in the Wisconsin Supreme Court against Secretary Designee Palm. There were many types of arguments floated during this time by interested parties, which centered around infringement on individual liberties. But we saw a very clear sort of simple way to succeed in overturning this order. And so, as we know, all agencies who oppose a new rule, despite what the agency calls it, must go through the rulemaking process. And so the thinking was, if we can convince a court that the Safer at Home order is indeed a rule, the court would then find that the order was unenforceable because it in no way had gone through any of the proper rulemaking process. And fortunately, the court agreed that the Safer at Home order was indeed a rule. Rule, as defined by our statutes, mean a regulation, standard, statement of policy, or general order of general application that has the force of law that was issued by an agency to interpret or implement specific legislation. And this order fits squarely within that definition in our mind and in the minds of the courts as well. And fortunately, the court agreed that indeed the order was a rule and should have had to go through the rulemaking process. Second, we argued, and the court ultimately agreed almost entirely, that DHS did not have the statutory authority to do a lot of what was done in the emergency order in the first place. So regardless of whether they went through the correct process or not, specifically including the shuttering of businesses and restricting travel and prohibiting private gatherings. So that, in a nutshell, are the two main arguments we made. The emergency order was a rule. It should have gone through rulemaking process. And second, whether it went through the rulemaking process or not, many of the actions taken in the emergency order DHS did not have the statutory authority to do in the first place.
Can you talk a little bit about the dissent in that case?
Sure. So a big part, and I'll let Ryan jump in here too on this and also talk about some of the implications of this case. But the dissent in this case saw a couple things. One, that there's some executive authority inherent in our Constitution that allows them to react appropriately to crises like this. I think there's this distinction between, potentially, between, what a governor can do versus what an administrative agency can do. It's directly subject to 27 requirements without exception. Justice Hagedorn's dissent, at least one of the sort of dissenting opinions he had as it relates to whether this particular emergency order was a rule, was that in his mind this applied to a very specific scenario. It wasn't something that had sort of quote general application as is required in the definition of a rule. So that's where where their dissent, you know, really sort of turned is that it's at least in Justice Hagedorn's mind, this isn't a rule because while it may be a general order, it doesn't have general application because it's applied to a very specific set of circumstances. I think our response to that would certainly be that, you know, the legislature has been granted what's called administrative agencies have been granted by the legislature emergency rulemaking authority, which by its terms in the statute is time limited and thus suggests that something that is a general order of general application can also be time limited and tied to a very specific set of circumstances.
Okay, thank you. Then we finally get to hear from Ryan then on the implications of this case.
Great. Well, thanks, Jesse. So I think one big implication is that courts after Palm need to seriously consider and scrutinize the labels that agencies put on their documents. So the Department of Health Services could call Emergency Order 28 an order. They could call it a statement of policy. They could call it whatever they want. But the legal question under the Administrative Procedure Act, just as the legal question in any federal administrative case is one under the Federal Administrative Procedure Act, is what substantively is this document? And somewhat confusingly, our Administrative Procedure Act says some orders are just so big that they should be treated as rules. Now, traditionally in administrative law, an order is something like what a court issues in a case. So the NLRB might issue an order in a labor dispute, or the EPA might issue an order on a permit application. And rules, and so orders tend to be backwards looking. Rules tend to be prospective looking, and they tend to be the kinds of things that we see in statutory provisions. So that's the general breakdown of the two. The Administrative Procedure Act says some orders might be of such broad application that they are effectively rules, even if the agency calls them orders. Supreme Court said that's 100% correct. We have to evaluate what this document is purporting to do. I think that's a big deal going forward because agencies like to put labels on things because they seek to accomplish certain ends sometimes. And, you know, their views are entitled to whatever weight they're entitled to. Not a lot these days in Wisconsin, but they're certainly not controlling. A second implication is, as Lane mentioned, Act 21 is finally being enforced and embraced by courts in Wisconsin. It's not as though courts had been ignoring it. It just hadn't come up squarely in a case really forcing a court to grapple with its provisions. So Act 21 says you agencies can't tell anyone what to do unless that thing you're telling them to do is specific and explicit in a statute or rule. And it also says that agencies can't find rulemaking authority in general statutes. Rulemaking authority has to be explicitly given to them. So what happened in Palm was that the Secretary of the Department of Health Services asserted under her statute alone, which gave her general power to look after the health of Wisconsinites and prevent against outbreaks and the like, that gave her specific authority to issue orders. The word orders is mentioned in that statute. And those orders can do whatever she wants them to do. The problem is that Act 21 was passed directly in response to generic powers and duties statutes like the one that DHS cited in Palm. It's not enough to say, well, we have the power to, you know, generally look after Wisconsinites in a health emergency, and therefore we can do whatever. No, it has to be specifically laid out. And that's surprising to some people because it used to be in Wisconsin that implied authority was just as good as explicit authority. And that's probably true in the federal system as well. Agencies, you know, under Chevron deference and other doctrines, they can say, well, we have this generic grant of authority over here, and within that generic grant are these things that are implicit. In Wisconsin, you just can't do that anymore. Where the Act 21 means that the legislature now has to tell agencies what specifically to do, and or give them rulemaking authority, which can be used to tell Wisconsinites what explicitly is required of them. And if they don't do either of those things, there is no binding rule of decision that can come from an agency. So this particular question and the implications of Act 21 going forward is really teed up in the Kinnard Farms case, in the Clean Wisconsin case, which Lane and I will discuss in a minute. I'll say it probably should be kicked off by Lane, because although I used to be a lawyer representing the state of Wisconsin in that case, I am no longer employed by the state, and the subsequent attorney general didn't like my briefs, didn't like our briefs. Amy Miller helped, she's on the call. And so unfortunately he pulled them, and that made us very sad. But we do know a few things about the case nevertheless. But I'll let Lane, you kick it off, and then I'm happy to weigh in.
Ryan, how could somebody not like your briefs since you have won Wisconsin Best Brief Award, I think 3 years running? Is that right, Ryan? I don't mean to let you turn.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know if that one can be submitted. It's like that. It's like it doesn't even exist. It never exists.
No, you were on the 30 under 30. Like, you're over 30, but you're still all right. So somebody should have told me.
Downhill since 30. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
I wasn't kidding with Ryan's awards on that. I'm quite salty. I can't seem to break into that award because it's now being designated the Ryan Walsh 30 under 30 award, I guess. I guess I'm just not eligible anymore.
Yeah.
Well, you can do what the rest of us do and lie about your age. So no problem. okay, back on track. Lane, would you like to start talking about the Kinnard case?
Yeah, sure. So I think Ryan teed it up really well, what this case is about and the far-reaching implications of this case. Just a little background. So the Department of Natural Resources approved 9 high-capacity well permits whose validity was then challenged by Clean Wisconsin. The question at issue in these companion cases is whether an agency must consider only the authority that is given to it explicitly, or if they may consider some other sources of authority as well, which Ryan has referred to as implicit authority. So it's this question again of what actions can an agency take, and do they need explicit authority, or can they draw from this implicit authority? On April 9th of 2019, the Wisconsin Supreme Court actually accepted this case and its companion case, the Kinnard Farms case. On April 25th, 2019, the legislature moved to intervene in the case. And as Ryan mentioned, on May 2nd of 2019, following a change in leadership at the Department of Justice, the DNR moved to reverse its prior position and asked the court to vacate the permit. So essentially completely switch sides in the case. And this case is pending right now in the Supreme Court because this question of whether the legislature can intervene is still being litigated. However, with the latest update, not only sort of in the original SEIU decision that Misha discussed, but also this latest sort of reaffirmation of what the legislature can and can't do as it relates to intervening in these types of cases. In DNC v. Bostelman, we're very optimistic that the legislature will be able to intervene and represent the interests of the state in this particular case. And representing the interest in the reading of Chapter 227 is requiring agencies to have explicit authority, which I think has been fairly well settled by all of the previous cases that I've discussed. This case is particularly important, especially in the sort of realm of environmental law, because there has existed some uncertainty for a time for the regulated community, and frankly, probably for administrative agencies, as to whether a previous case dealing with sort of a similar circumstances called Lake Beulah, which only briefly mentioned Act 21 in a footnote, whether that case is still controlling law or whether Act 21's explicit authority requirement is indeed now controlling. And another a ruling by the Supreme Court that, again, explicit authority is required, the DNR can't actually impose other conditions or requirements in issuing these high capacity well permits that aren't in statute would be a huge victory for the regulated community. And a finding that the Lake Beulah decision isn't controlling law would ensure that especially the DNR's authority is not vastly expanded beyond this explicit authority requirement.
Ryan, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, sure. And I think that gets it just right. I think Kinnard Farms is the same kind of case. It tees up the same question. The basic structure of the issue is, can an agency, when it has a statute that says, here are the things you can impose on a permit, can it go beyond those things by pointing to some implicit grant of authority to require more things of the regulated entity? In Kinnard Farms, the case centers on a CAFO, a concentrated animal feeding operation. And it has to do with cows and how many cows you can have on your CAFO. And there are statutes, because this is Wisconsin, there are statutes and rules that address cows. They don't say anything about having, you know, an upper limit on the number of dairy cows you can have at your CAFO. Nonetheless, DNR, in this case, had issued a permit that says you can have only so many cows and you have to have these drainage sites in these various places around the property. None of that comes from a statute. And so Kinnard Farms argued, and the state of Wisconsin used to argue, that that was impermissible. Or I guess maybe in Kinnard Farms we had issued the, I don't remember if we had issued the permit without the conditions, and somebody complained about that. Either way, it got teed up that way. And so it's the same kind of, it's the same kind of dispute as Clean Wisconsin. And it's a really practical one, I think, for regulated entities, for the agencies. They have to just need, everybody needs clarity on what agencies can and can't do. And I think fortunately we're gonna get that.
Do you think it's much broader than the cases Lane was discussing earlier about Lamar and it kind of, again, going back to Act 21, is this then the big seminal case that we should be looking for coming out?
Yeah, it's one of them. It feels like there are many, but I think this is probably the seminal one that we know about going forward. So another thing that's happening in the background, which was foreshadowed in Palm, is that there's a constitutional doctrine known as the non-delegation doctrine. Sometimes people just call this plain separation of powers, which suggests that, which holds that agency officials and other executive branch officials in general can't wield what is essentially legislative-like authority, even if the legislature says, you know, go ahead and regulate as you see fit. And that was an issue in Palm because DHS's argument was that because they are the health agency, they can issue a stay-at-home order or whatever else they think necessary, because, you know, that's their mission from the legislature. This is coming up in the federal context in a case, I think, filed in Georgia, where the CDC has issued a moratorium on evictions. And they're arguing, well, this is part of our statutory authority as the Centers for Disease Control, because if people are getting evicted, it's more likely that the virus is going to spread because people won't be indoors. So it's the same kind of argument. It's like, if they have the authority to do whatever is necessary to protect the public health, there's almost nothing they can't do. And the court latched onto that in Palm and read the statute giving DHS its general authorities narrowly because it wanted to avoid throwing its constitutionality into doubt. And so they read the words, you know, to mean what they said on the paper and nothing more. There was no kind of implied extra authority that came with those words. And that was to avoid, you know, striking them down or saying, you know, something dramatic about what executive officials can't do under the Constitution.
I want to back up a little bit and ask you, Ryan, about the state of agency deference, because you had made a comment earlier when we started talking about these cases that agencies don't get the deference that they used to in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about where it is now and how it got to be that way and how that might be different? You touched on this as well than, say, the federal government with Chevron.
Right. So in federal administrative law, there is a doctrine called Chevron, which means more or less that where there is an ambiguity in a statute and an agency gives a reasonable reading to that ambiguity. The agency's view of the law governs, and no contrary reading of the statute, even a reading given by a federal court, controls. That doctrine has been chipped away at over the years. You know, we've heard about the controversies surrounding it through the confirmation proceedings of Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. I'm sure we'll hear about it again with Judge Barrett. But for the most part, Chevron doctrine is still in place. In Wisconsin, there was a version of it. And in a couple of cases that Misha and I and our colleagues handled back when we used to work for the state, called Tetra Tech and DWD, and there was maybe one other one, the court was asked to decide whether our version of Chevron deference was in accord with our Administrative Procedure Act, or, and if it was, whether that deference was unconstitutional because it gave agency officials the power to say what the law is, which is the power of the courts. The court in those cases didn't reach the constitutional question because they didn't have to. The way we briefed it was that it was just flatly inconsistent with the state APA, which calls upon courts to answer questions of law. And, you know, of course, the agency gets respect as any other expert in a substantive area of law or subject matter gets respect, but they're not entitled to any kind of thumb on the scale, just as a prosecutor isn't entitled to a thumb on the scale in a criminal case. There's nothing about being the government that gets you that extra deference. So the court adopted that position, and I don't know, maybe the other panelists know, if there's been any follow-on litigation chipping away at related deference doctrines in administrative law in Wisconsin, but I haven't seen any of it myself.
I think then I have more questions, but I'm looking at the time and I don't want to take away all of that. So maybe we can go back to Misha, because this is another really interesting case, and talk about the Dane County school closure cases. There were several of them, if that would be okay, Misha.
Great, yeah. So this, I'm sure most of the people on this call know about this. At the 11th hour, about a month ago, Dane County purported to shut down all of the private schools. Some schools that are already opened for the fall term, and most of the other ones were ready to open the next week. There were three petitions for original action brought in the state Supreme Court, and a couple of companion emergency motions for temporary injunction. I represented a coalition of Catholic parents and Catholic schools, a Wisconsin law Institute of Law and Liberty represented some parents in a school, and Joe Voiland and his firm represented a family. The state Supreme Court, in a 4-3 decision, granted a stay, allowing all of the private schools to open, concluding that local health officials could not close schools. While it was not part of the stay decision, there's also a very powerful constitutional arguments in that case that the religious parents and schools are bringing. The injunction is currently in place, but merits briefing is still ongoing. An oral argument on that case is scheduled for December 8th. So that will be another very significant case that should set some interesting precedent for the state.
And I guess, Ryan, would you like to talk about how happy you are that your kids can go back to school?
Very happy. They're happy too.
Well, Lane, you as well. I know your little guy is going to school now too. He's too old. It doesn't sit in my brain well. So I guess what really is interesting to me is these agency deference decisions and the Act 21 decisions that are kind of getting at that separation of powers, the traditional roles of the branches, that from the cases that Lane was talking about, we saw unanimous decisions out of the court. Lane, Ryan, do you expect to see a unanimous decision in the Kinnard Farms case? Do you think it's going to be different because the issue is a little different? What do you think might drive that decision if either of you wants to take that?
And go ahead.
My inclination is that it I don't think it's going to be unanimous, and that's purely an instinctual answer because the issues are a little bit different. You know, interestingly, the PAPA case was decided unanimously subsequent to the legislature v. Palm case. And so I'm wondering then, you know, based on sort of the principles of stare decisis, if we'll see some respect for that moving forward in these types of cases or not. That's a big question. I think the issues are somewhat different. You know, it could be that in weighing, you know, the agency action, some of the justices might view it on a sliding scale of sort of, well, this is obviously well outside the bounds of their authority, whether explicit or implicit, versus this distinction between implicit or explicit. Not to mention, you know, when we speak of stare decisis, we've got this Lake Beulah case that has this footnote that sort of mentions Act 21, but it's unclear what that then means, you know, moving forward. So I think, you know, between the just the difference in the underlying circumstances and potentially this Lake Beulah footnote, I think we'll see a different outcome in those particular cases.
Ryan, do you agree with that? Do you have anything to add?
Nothing to add.
So with the agency deference, to me, like if you just look at the practical effects, you know, when Lane was talking before about for businesses, how they need certainty. And, you know, the one instance with the billboard, and that your entire business, if you're a healthcare provider, potentially being on the line, these will have ripple effects throughout basically the entire economy of Wisconsin. Are you seeing any more cases working their way through the circuit courts that are these sorts of issues that are coming up? Anything we should keep an eye on?
Lane, do you have anything on that?
I think we're going to be seeing a lot. I mean, especially depending on what happens in these companion cases, Clean Wisconsin and Kennard, we're going to probably see a lot of litigation surrounding DNR actions related to CAFOs, related to high capacity well permits. I think we're going to certainly see more of that. I don't know of a specific case offhand that might be of note to watch. Maybe Ryan or Misha, you do?
I don't. Off the top of my head, I would say that this is something that legal departments for companies should be paying close attention to. I don't think it's particularly hard to just, you know, when the government or when an agency is telling you to do something, and it's proposing it as a permit on the use of property or whatever else, and if you can't find that thing in a validly promulgated rule or in a statute, then a bell should go off in your head and you should think Act 21. I know regulated parties don't always want to pick fights with the government, and that makes sense, but you know, there are rights that folks should be asserting in this area, and I expect that people will be asserting those rights more often and more vociferously after legislature versus Palm and PAPA and the other cases.
I'd switch gears and go back to the SEIU decision, because that was obviously a big one for the legislature and just for the function of government. Misha, where do you see the litigation headed on that in the future?
Right. As I mentioned earlier, the state Supreme Court upheld almost all of the provisions against a facial challenge, and then a couple provisions that said they were not sufficiently briefed for it to decide, so it sent that back to the circuit court in Dane County, Judge Remington. In that court, the plaintiffs and the governor have now made clear they wish to amend their complaints to respond to the Supreme Court's decision. And we'll be seeing that next month. We'll see how they want to, and if they want to continue with a narrower version of their case. I think their kind of wish list results have now been taken off the table by the state Supreme Court. We'll see if they want to try for something more small bore. You know, what's really left to them is as-applied challenges. Generally, in order to bring in as-applied challenges, you have to have a specific factual context. It sure seems like any as-applied challenges are unripe at this time, but we will see what they try to do.
Do you think that yesterday's decision out of the Supreme Court in the DNC case that grants the legislature standing impacts any of this going forward? Because now the legislature is on solid footing to come in when the AG might not. Does that play into this at all?
Yeah, you know, that involved one potential as-applied challenge they could have brought, saying that the intervention statute as applied to cases where the legislature comes in to defend state law. Pretty clear after yesterday, that kind of argument would be off of the table. So we'll see what, if anything, they do on the intervention or the litigation provisions, or whether they focus on other aspects of the case in their amended complaint.
I guess my final question for all the panelists would be, where do you see the court going from here? Ryan, you talked a little bit about there's this larger issue out there of the non-delegation doctrine. Do you think that next term's court is going to start looking at those issues? Do you see cases that are on the brink, or you think people are going to be looking for opportunities to bring those? Just start with you. And it doesn't have to be about non-delegation. That was just something you had mentioned.
Yeah, I think in large part, Act 21 removes many of the concerns about non-delegation. I think non-delegation was a bigger problem before Act 21. And Act 21, you might understand Act 21 as the legislature's response to delegation run riot, as the Supreme Court once put it. So there should be a remedy to non-delegation and to, you know, agencies' use of fuzzy statutes to require specific things that regulated parties don't see coming. But I guess that does turn on whether the court continues to enforce Act 21 and its, you know, pretty profound meaning for Wisconsin administrative law. I suppose if they didn't do that, then the non-delegation would come back and rear its head.
I'm going to have to cut you off. I thought we had about another 30 seconds, but it's just about 1 o'clock and I don't want anybody to get cut off like sure. I just did there. So I'll just do it. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you all participating, and thank you for the people taking the time listening today's call. I really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll see you next time as well.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.